Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Another glorious day, the opening to a splendid work called Come to the Woods by one of America's most highly acclaimed composers. His name is Jake Runnestead. And Jake Runnestead has created a most enviable place for himself, particularly in the world of choral music. But Jake Runnestead is a talented composer in various genres, a winner of ASCAP's Morton Gould Young Composer Award. His works have been sung and played all across the country and indeed all over the world. He is one of the busiest choral composers and clinicians before the public today, and Carthage College is fortunate indeed to have him in residence today and tomorrow as part of Carthage's Lakeside Women's Choir Invitational. And Jake Runnestead will be kept busy with a number of different activities on the campus of Carthage, and everything culminates tomorrow afternoon at 4:15 with a special performance which will feature three of the high school guest choirs plus Carthage's own women's ensemble and Jake Runnestead on hand, where a couple of his works will be performed, one by the Mass Choir and one by the Carthage Women's Ensemble. And I am just delighted beyond words to be able to welcome Jake Runnestead into our studios this morning and onto the morning show. Jake Runnestead, we welcome you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So happy to have you. And it's really an interesting experience to look across the table and see you in that seat where back in the fall, your first great compositional mentor, Libby Larson, sat as a guest of this morning show. She was a guest of Carthage for an instrumental undertaking with the director of instrumental music, Jim Ripley, and now here you are, in a sense, in her very seat. We'll get to your connection with her in just a moment. We should tell everybody right off the bat that you are certainly born and raised and still deeply rooted in the Midwest. Tell our listeners a little bit about where you come from and about some of your earliest musical experiences in the great city of Rockford, Illinois.
Sure, yeah, Rockford, Illinois, home of the voice of the Little Mermaid, Jodie Benson, home of Kurt Elling, the great jazz singer, home of Cheap Trick, and the tube sock was invented in Rockford, Illinois. So these strings of fantastic things that come out of that city.
So you're just way down the list.
That's right. Yeah, born and raised in Rockford, two very musical parents, very musical family, lots of singing around the house. My parents were in various choirs and church choir. My dad sang in a quartet. My mom did a lot of musical theater. And so when my sister and I were kids, instead of getting a babysitter, parents would bring us along to their rehearsals. Mm. And so I think a lot of that seeped into my brain as I was a kid. I went to, was in Rockford throughout high school. Was in a couple bands in high school, writing a lot of terrible love songs because I knew nothing about love. And I did a lot of recording. I saved up all my money to buy a multi-track recorder with a built-in CD burner. It was like the coolest thing ever. I didn't buy a car. I bought that. And so that's how I learned to orchestrate. I'd record a piano part and then a vocal part and then vocal harmony and then saxophone or strings or percussion and kind of build it all together just based on sound. And so when I was a senior in high school, I wrote a piece for my high school wind ensemble. So that was the first time I notated music for other people to perform. So it was kind of an aha, really exciting moment.
Yeah, that's a breakthrough. You were, I think, a saxophonist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And it is not an omission for you to not have mentioned singing yet, because, in fact, you weren't somebody who sang in the choir.
No.
You played in the band, which is going to be probably quite a shock to most people who know you for your wonderful choral music. But did you sing in the band? I mean, sing in these bands that you had?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the bands with my friends. Yeah.
So it's not that you were incapable of singing.
No, yeah, lots of singing, just not in an ensemble. You know?
Interesting.
So my first time in a real ensemble was sophomore year of college.
Wow. How did that happen?
I like to say I was conned into it because I was a bass and I could read music. And, you know, many choirs are often looking for tenors and basses. And so I thought, what the heck? Why not? I'll give it a shot.
So it was not an experience you were hungry for or particularly seeking out.
Not necessarily.
It came seeking you.
I think I had been interested. And so something, oh, yeah, I'll give it a try.
So this is at Winona State.
Uh-huh.
And what were you studying there?
Instrumental music education. So I was going to be, if you know Mr. Holland's Opus, the movie, I wanted to be Mr. Holland, where I teach band and I write music on the side, and someday my students, we get together and perform it, and that kind of thing.
Surprise you
yeah,
on your
exactly.
retirement.
Exactly.
Well, that didn't quite work out, did it? But
yeah.
But you obviously had, at that point, some interest in composing. In fact, how serious at that point were you about composing?
So I've always, I guess, I never made a decision that I'm going to be a composer. I've been writing music, creating music for most of my life, and so it's just something I did. So throughout college, I was writing pieces for choir. I was writing pieces for the wind band, and what was great is that the ensembles at my school were so open to performing. The wind band, Dr. Lovejoy, he'd always say, well, at least read the piece, you know, in a rehearsal. But he always ended up performing it. It was really great. So that was amazing for a composer to be able to hear all of those works performed. And then I actually started a choir outside of school with some of my friends. And so that was an opportunity to try out new music, to practice my own conducting. And so I had these incredible outlets for the music, which was such a great learning experience.
Right. One of the things that I've certainly true for me in the little composing that I've done, and particularly early on, and a lot of young composers I know, is that most of them don't know what a wastebasket is, and tend to think that everything that streams out of their pen and onto the page is what it should be, and you know, just because I wrote it, it must be distinctive and worthy of existence, and of course at some point people start to get more serious and in a sense more exacting with their standards and realize that just because I wrote this doesn't make it in and of itself intrinsically valuable as music,
or
I mean, not in the way that you might think, in a little more naive fashion. How about you? Did you know where the wastebasket was early on? I mean, did you have some sense of a bar of excellence that I want to attain, or did you, like some young composers, feel like everything you wrote was great? Maybe everything you wrote was great even then.
I think that I had a lot of exploration early on. And no one, I don't think anyone has heard that music, you know, unless my family, they were walking by when I was playing around in my studio that I kind of created when I was in high school. But I think that was a really important part of my development, is that, you know, throughout middle school and high school, I was just creating all kinds of stuff that no one heard, you know, I just kind of kept it to myself, but it was, you know, I would try a lot and then figure out what works and what doesn't and listen and experience it so that, you know, when I started writing other things, I think I had a pretty clear sense of what would work better than other things. Now, that doesn't mean everything is perfect and that, you know, there are plenty of things that of my notated music that that don't see the light of day just because I consider them earlier works. And but yeah, I think that was a really important part. And a lot of it also was just the idea that I was creating without judgment. You know, it's not like I knew that I had to have it notated and that it had to be perfect, but I was just exploring sound. And I think that I always give that advice to young composers is, you know, don't sit down and expect to write everything out and it's going to be perfect. You know, go into a practice room or somewhere with your instrument and just make sounds that you like and just be creative, because we can teach you harmony and orchestration and counterpoint, but we can't teach creativity. Hmm. And so I think that's one of the most important things is create without judgment. And then you can hone in and figure out how to develop motives and all of that. So
in a sense, that first part has to happen where you create unfettered by, in a sense, the expectations or the judgment of others.
Yeah, I think so.
But understanding that at some point, if you start ushering your own music into the world, especially for potentially for strangers to perform,
right?
Then you have to be ready for something else, including some of that judgment.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of like cooking. You know, you you first learn about it by eating food. You know, by listening to music, you learn about what's out there, and then you experiment with your own dishes, maybe, and then you can read a cookbook to learn more, and then you begin to branch out and try your own recipes that you might create or variations. And but you've got to try it kind of within the safety of your own kitchen first before you let other people eat it. You don't right. want to make them sick.
Exactly. Right. Let alone the restaurant critics.
Yeah, exactly.
So, we're speaking with composer Jake Runnestad. He is on the campus of Carthage College today and tomorrow for the Lakeside Women's Choir Invitational. And his visit to Carthage will culminate in a special concert tomorrow afternoon at 4:15 in Siebert Chapel, to which the public is welcome to attend, where a couple of his works are going to be performed. Jake Runnestad is one of the country's most renowned composers, particularly of choral music, even just at the tender age of, I don't know,
you're 30.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're just a baby. So you go to Winona State University officially to pursue a teaching teaching degree. And then you cross paths with a renowned composer who visits Winona State for a residency, the aforementioned Libby Larson. Tell us what happened when she came to campus and the way in which this really transformed who you were about or what you were about.
Yeah, so Libby was commissioned to write a piece for the orchestra. And so she came down for the premiere and for a short residency, working with students and giving a lecture and things like that. And at the same time, the Wind Ensemble was rehearsing one of my pieces that I'd written. And the orchestra conductor, who was friends with Libby, you know, approached me and said, you know, I know you're a composer. Would you like to meet with Libby when she comes to town? And I was just, I was like, uh-huh, yes, I would. You know, this extraordinary composer and person and supporter of new music and everything. And so Libby came to the rehearsal of the wind band doing my piece. And then I met with her afterwards. And she asked me a bunch of questions that I had never really thought about or been asked before, just about my process and you know, my approach is to composition. And then at the end of our time together, she said, Jake, I'd like for you to study with me, you know, in her incredibly energetic and brilliant way. And I was just, you know, so excited, of course. And so I drove up to her home in Minneapolis and had a few lessons with her. And during those, you know, they were just transformative for me. I think the biggest thing I learned from her was thinking more about the why of my music. Hmm. And so why use this harmony, or how why this texture? What is this describing, or what does this mean? Or why does the melody move this way? And then how can you, you know, shift it here in order to help with the understanding of the text or whatever it might be? So, you know, not so technical, but thinking more of the deeper levels of the music, which was extraordinary for me, you know. And then she also encouraged me to attend graduate school. So she had suggested some places and some teachers. And so I applied and kind of last minute decided to go. And I attended the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore.
And the rest is history from that point on. It sounds like you really flourished in sort of the rigors of studying composition. And I know that some people don't, only because if it's something that's maybe intensely personal and quite spontaneous, and then they kind of resent the intrusion of somebody who steps in to, in a sense, teach you how to do it better, or maybe teach you how to do it at all, compared to what that experience was before. And it sounds like you, by contrast, were hungry for that and benefited so richly in every way.
Hmm. Yeah, I think my view is that art can change and maybe should change in order to be most effective or most meaningful. And so especially in an element where I'm to be learning, it's so important to be open to that. And so, of course, anything that Libby or my teacher in grad school, Kevin Putz, might say is really crucial and important to take into account and to incorporate that into the work.
Wonderful. I want us to listen to some more music, and I want to play for our listeners your marvelous Alleluia, which happens to be the first thing by you that I ever heard, and it was because the Carthage Choir performed it several years ago under the direction of Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli. Although this is not them singing it, it's I don't remember now this ensemble, but this is from your own YouTube channel. But I want our listeners to enjoy this. Can you tell us when this was composed and for whom?
Sure. I believe the premiere was in 2014 at the Western ACDA Conference, the American Choral Directors Association. It was commissioned by the Salt Lake Vocal Artists, Brady Allred, conductor. And they had a requirement. They were asked to perform at this conference, and they had 3 minutes of time to fill. Mm. And so he said, all right, I need a piece. No, it can't be longer than 3 minutes. I was like, okay. And so I thought, well, I could find a text and try and make it work. But I figured, you know, Alleluia is a word that is so lovely to be sung. It can be used in so many different ways. And so the piece has three sections, kind of this energetic, jubilant opening, and then a more introspective middle section, and then we return to kind of this dance and jubilance at the end. So that's Alleluia.
Here it is. Let's listen to it, and then this is the music of Jake Runnestad.
Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia.
Well, that's another thing. Jake Runnestad's setting of Alleluia. Jake Runnestad, one of the things I wanted to ask you is the fact that, I think you said this before we went on the air, that you sometimes feel like you were abducted by the choral world because as a musician you actually began much more as an instrumentalist, although you've always sung, but you certainly are a relative newcomer to choral music as a singer. I mean, as you said, that only happened in your sophomore year in college. So I wonder the fact that you have this extensive background as an instrumentalist, what kind of difference you think that has made in the kind of choral composer that you are? In what way do you think that has been an enrichment to who you are?
Yeah, I think that especially with rhythm and harmony. So I saxophone was my main instrument in college, and I was in I did a lot of jazz as well. And so actually thinking about reading music and reading rhythms, I think that I really learned most about that through playing jazz. You know, syncopation and, you know, when you got, just feeling the rhythms that go in between the notes that you play. And then being in the wind band world too, there tends to be, you know, these different elements of rhythm especially. It just felt natural to bring that into voices. And I think sometimes when composers are writing vocal music, it's almost like they forget that the voice is capable of so many things, and especially rhythm being one of them, and percussive sounds, I think it's important to take advantage of those kinds of things, and also make a line very singable or playable in that context, instead of just kind of being a sustained line, but give the singer something they can really sink their voice into. And then also thinking about the choir in terms of orchestrating, like for an orchestra or for a wind band, where there are certain colors that you can use, and certain vowels are going to create certain colors, and just bring a solo line here and then add other voices, or there are so many things we can do instead of it just being four-part harmony at all times. There's so many, I like to call them colors to play with, like a palette that a painter uses. If you have all the colors at one time, that painting isn't going to be very attractive. Just like cooking, all the spices in one dish, you've got to be careful with what you put in there.
Sure, don't dump everything
that's
in,
right,
and don't
right.
leave it bland. Typically, what is your process? Particularly, I mean, you are a professional composer making a fine living as a composer, and of course, what sustains you ultimately are the multitude of commissions that you are given, where someone asks you and pays you to create a brand new piece of music for them. First of all, how does that process typically happen? Do people simply just come knocking at your door, and do you essentially accept every commission opportunity that comes your way, or do you need to think about certain things that make an opportunity right or not right for you?
Sure. Well, we all start small, and so first starting out, of course, I was working quite hard to connect with people and to begin getting commissions. Thinking right out of grad school, it's not like a degree magically makes it that you all of a sudden receive all the commissions of everyone just because
right.
you have a master's.
Your light doesn't automatically blink on your answering machine.
That's right. But right now I'm at the point where, people contact me, and I've got a busy schedule, so I've got to manage, what am I able to take on? And so I do have to say no, which I feel very lucky to be in that place. And it's also kind of frustrating because there's so many projects that I wish I could do. I'm like, if I want to be sane, I need to say no
right.
to this.
I suppose part of the issue, people need to understand that many of these commissions are, in a sense, time sensitive, because it might be some huge all-state choir that would love you to write something for their next festival,
right.
which is in March of next year.
Exactly.
And you need to look at your calendar in order to see if such a thing is possible.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. So I've got to figure, okay, so if I have this piece due here and this piece due here, okay, am I able to do another one? Or, you know, but I've got this travel, so I need to make sure that I really plan for that. Hmm. So.
I think some people thinking about your life and responding to opportunities like this probably kind of wonder, I do too, what it would feel like to have a really significant commission and essentially a blank canvas, blank manuscript paper in front of you, and with one just hoping that the ideas will appear and something will take shape. I mean, I suppose by now you are so good at this and already have such a commendable track record, you probably don't have the fear that you probably did right off the bat. I mean, wondering, am I going to be able to create something? Or right from the start, was that never much of an issue or concern for you?
Oh, of course. There's always intimidation, I think. You know, when I got a call from Craig Hella Johnson and Consperare wanting a new piece, Come to the Woods, the first one you played, you know, of course that's, you know, this is a Grammy-winning group, and I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to, oh, geez, this has to be good. But it's gotten to a point where I trust my creativity and I kind of have to, and also just remind myself that, you know, it will come. Sometimes it takes a little longer than other pieces, depending on what it is, but that it'll happen. And it's intimidating to look at a blank piece of manuscript paper and think, I could put anything on here. What am I going to do? But there's this great line from the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, in which they're discussing how do you describe a building. You know, if you're writing about describing a building, how on earth do you do that? Like, you have this huge building. I said, well, you start in the lower left-hand corner. And so I think that's how I approach the music is, I know there's a building there. I know roughly what it looks like and what it's made out of. But when I have to begin to write, I have to start small, you know, with the basic building block and then build it up from there.
More than 20 years ago, I was privileged to meet Alice Parker when she came to Carthage for a week-long residency. And it was actually my wife who asked her over dinner what was her advice for an aspiring young composer. And one of her, the central bit of advice she had was, write for people you know. I mean, call up your local high school choir director and said, I would love to write a piece of music for your choir. And you know, I don't need to be paid, but I mean, I would love to do that. But the point was to not write a piece of music that the whole universe will love. Write a piece of music for your own church choir or the high school choir down the road or whatever, but respond to the voices around you and write something that is, in a sense, catered to a particular ensemble and their sound, and that is where you will end up tapping into your most authentic voice as a composer versus, as I said, writing just for the ether. And I found that to be really intriguing advice. I wonder if you have found that to be true, that part of what has inspired you to write all of these marvelous works are sometimes the wonderful groups whom you know versus those opportunities where you're writing, in a sense, for complete strangers. And does that change the experience?
Yeah, every time I write a piece, I really try to get to know the group that's going to be performing it, whether that's you know, a group that I have worked with before, or if I know the conductor. In some cases, I've created a questionnaire that I'll put on my website, and then send that to the ensemble and inquire about, you know, their passions and why they sing, or what they're interested in, what topics they're interested in, or what's relevant to their lives. And so that's really helpful for me to get an understanding. And then also part of it is, you know, what is the ability level of this ensemble? And so, you know, writing a piece for Consperare, a professional ensemble, is different than writing for a collegiate ensemble, just depending on the level of performance. So I take that all into account as far as what I'm going to be writing for that group. It also sometimes is dependent upon the theme of the piece. For example, one of my pieces called And So I Go On was commissioned by a conductor who had lost his fiancée. And so the meaning and the intent behind that piece is going to be very different when I know I'm writing it for his ensemble versus, you know, just some other choir.
Right. That touches on the deeply personal nature of many of the works that you have composed, and also the fact that you are someone with a real passion for social justice and for the music you compose to make a very tangible difference in the world, a difference for the better. For instance, tell our listeners about one of your most recent works called Please Stay.
Yeah. So this was a commission by 20-some college choirs in Ohio. It was put together as a consortium. And just knowing that that was going to be a large opportunity for kind of a larger statement, because so many groups were doing it, I wanted to address something that I thought was especially poignant. And in my life, I've had several people that I know who have struggled with depression and also suicide, and one in particular who completed suicide. And so knowing that that is something that is so present in our culture and in many ways is pushed to the side, or there's a stigma surrounding conversation about mental health. And so I think it's important that we talk about it. And so through my art, I hoped to create a work that would allow us to talk about it, that would help people to know that if they're struggling with these things, that they're not alone. They're not the only ones. Mm-hmm. And so this was for choirs, and so I needed a text. And there's an organization called To Write Love on Her Arms, and mm-hmm. they do a lot with awareness and prevention of depression and suicide. And so every year they have a campaign just to help spread this awareness. Last year's campaign was called And So I Kept Living. And they encouraged people to go to Twitter and to share reasons that they chose to live when struggling with the thoughts of suicide. And so you can go to Twitter and you can use the hashtag #IKeptLiving, which allows you to search and find all of these entries that people have written. So I read through hundreds of them, and they're so powerful and so raw and so real and so human. And so I it was hard to choose the right ones, but I used several of those tweets for the text of the piece. And so the piece is this this declaration of hope for someone who might be struggling. And then near the end of the piece, there's a repetition of please stay, just stay in the choir. And speakers come forward and they speak some of these tweets, you know, such as, you know, see, I'm trying to think of one. You know, all I can think about is Nathan. I wish that he kept living. You know, someone took the time to listen and understand. Sometimes that's all it takes. So it's just really amazing words. And so it's been a really meaningful experience to hear that piece come to life. And I've received so many messages and people approaching me after the performance already, just sharing their own stories. And so my hope is that, yeah, it will foster conversation around this topic and kind of destigmatize the idea of mental health.
Wow. Tell us about another really powerful work of yours that many people know well, called Dreams of the Fallen, and what prompted that to be composed.
Yeah, so Dreams of the Fallen was really my first big commission, and it was a consortium commission of five different professional orchestras around the country. And this was in, I think it started in 2012 was when I, and then I finished it in 2013. And it's a 25-minute work for solo piano, chorus, and orchestra. So just about as many people as you can fit on stage as possible. So talk about intimidation.
Yeah. Like Beethoven's choral fantasy.
Right, exactly.
Same forces. Interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of part piano concerto and part choral symphony. And so I was trying to figure out, well, what am I going to do with all those people on stage? And I knew that because the piano is right up front, I wanted to somehow give the piano a character, an identity. And around that time, I had seen a video series from the New York Times that was exploring people who had served in Iraq and had returned home and attempted to assimilate back into everyday life, and what a struggle that was, given the things they experienced. For example, as I was working on the piece, and I went to hear the fireworks at 4th of July, and I became so somber because I was thinking about, wow, someone who lost their best friend to a bomb, and what they must be feeling when they hear these explosions of the fireworks. Mm. I think that seemingly that simple, and how it affects their world. And so I decided that that would be the theme of the piece. And so I discovered the poetry of Brian Turner, who was a poet first and then served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and has extraordinary texts about what it was like to experience war and then return. And so I use several of his poems in this piece that the choir sings. And then the piano serves as kind of that individual who has experienced war. Mm. And has these what I call dreams or these memories of the experience, and so there's kind of an interaction with the choir and the piano.
I know I've read some comments you made. I don't recall now if it was about this work or something else around a similar weighty theme, where you expressed concern about, in a sense, not wanting to trivialize mm-hmm. a really painful or powerful experience of someone else. To sort of enter that story with your own gifts as a composer. And I so appreciated the way you phrased that, because I think someone else could come in with less sensitivity and, in a sense, less humility. And probably part of what has allowed you to create what you have is, well, just what I said, that sense mm-hmm. of sensitivity and humility when you undertake something like this, especially when it tells someone else's deeply personal story.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's so important. Yeah, I don't pretend to know what it's like to experience war. I haven't served, but I, as a part of my research and my planning for the piece, I had to educate myself. It's like an actor researching a role, you know. And so, talking with people who have experienced it and reading books and articles and trying to enter into an element of what that might be like, and then maybe trying to, in some possible way, to relate it to an experience in my life so that I have something to draw upon. You know, it's obvious it's not going to be the same, but somehow enter into that emotional world as well as I can.
I would like us to listen at least to a little bit of an exceptionally powerful piece of yours called Let My Love Be Heard. Tell us briefly the circumstances under which this was composed.
So this was commissioned by a wonderful ensemble, Choral Arts Northwest, based in Seattle, and I've written a couple pieces for them. And this piece was for a candlelit, kind of intimate concert experience, and they had a beautiful performance of the piece. And it's so fascinating because you never know the life that a piece is going to have. The choir at Cal State Long Beach in California, they had lost one of their students in the Paris attacks in 2015. And the choir performed at a vigil for this student. And then the next day, the choir was supposed to begin rehearsing holiday music. This was in like November. Mm. And they just weren't ready. And so the conductor emailed me, on a Sunday night, and said, "Hey, can you send me this piece? We would love to record it and offer it to our community." And so in one rehearsal, they rehearsed and recorded the piece. And I think it's probably one of my favorite recordings of any of my pieces, because there's so much emotion that you can hear as they sing it.
exquisite masterwork in so many ways. Let My Love Be Heard by Jake Runnestad. Jake Runnestad, I'm sure you feel a thousand times over such gratitude when you find a text which, in a sense, already has music in it, that, and you're there to, in a sense, unlock it. There's just nothing like being presented with a text or finding a text that taps into your deepest gifts.
Absolutely. And this one was really special. I've only found it in one place. It's a text by Alfred Noyes, a British poet. And when my grandfather died, my grandmother gave me a collection of poetry that belonged to him. And it's these beautiful little red books. And there are, I think, five or six of them. And so this poem was in that collection, and that's the only place that I've ever found it. I get messages from people asking, you know, I can't find this poem anywhere. I've looked online. And it's Alfred Noyes, and that's the only place that I've found it. So, yeah, it's extraordinary text.
Wow, just so beautiful, incredibly beautiful. You are going to be standing in front of young singers, particularly tomorrow. And one of my former voice students, who is now studying choral music down in Texas, named Andrew McNair, wrote this to me last night on Facebook when I asked for stories about you. He wrote, was in a masterclass with him on his We Can Mend the Sky and Let My Love Be Heard. Wonderful experience. He was very open to how the music could be made that day and how each phrase could be treated differently from day to day. You and him were the only composers that I've ever had the opportunity to rehearse their music with. Just say a quick word about that experience of a given piece of music being sung differently day to day.
Yeah, I think we heard it just in the recording you played. You know, this group who was experiencing so much grief, and then they sing this music, and you can just hear the grief in their sound, in the way that they shape their phrases. I think it's extraordinary. And I think that's so important that we respond to the music as a living, breathing art form, and that it should change, and that you know, it can't just be the same every time, but that we need to respond to what's happening in our lives and in the world. And I always encourage ensembles to have that flexibility of, you know, I don't want my music to be exactly the same every time. And so to be able to allow a phrase to be elongated or to rise in a new way so that we can find meaning in it, I think is really, really important.
Hmm. Have you yet gotten accustomed to this notion of complete strangers singing your music?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's thrilling to, you know, have a new video pop up on YouTube from, you know, X choir in South Korea or in Poland, and to see what they bring to it. It's really neat. It's really exciting. I love just hearing and seeing what people bring to the music. It's a thrill.
Very good. Before I let you go, my friend from Luther College and fellow public radio personality Brian Newhouse of Minnesota Public Radio said I should ask you about the donuts.
Yeah, so I guess it's become kind of a gimmick, but everywhere I travel quite a bit, you know, working with groups all around the world, and everywhere I travel, I try a donut. So I've got to find, you know, the best donut in town here. But, not that I obsess over eating donuts every day of my life, but I think it's fun, you know, in every community just to kind of find what they're doing in the donut world. So that's a little thing I like to do.
Well, I'll have a couple of good suggestions for you off the air. Since
all right.
Public radio shouldn't be hawking donuts over the airwaves.
That's right.
But in the meantime, Jake Runnestad, I know you got in late last night. I'm so glad that you were willing to come on the air for this conversation today. It's great to give people the opportunity to know the man behind so many wonderful works that have given such pleasure and inspiration to so many people. And we want to remind people about Jake Runnestad's participation in Carthage's Lakeside Women's Choir Invitational, and he'll be working with high school women's ensembles all day long tomorrow, and the event will culminate in a special concert 4:15 tomorrow afternoon in Siebert Chapel. where a couple of different works by Jake Runnested, including Sing Wearing the Sky, will be performed. The public is welcome. The concert is free, 4:15 tomorrow afternoon at Carthage's Sieber Chapel. Jake Runnested, we're going to go out with just a few measures of one of your most fun pieces, Nyan Nyan, as sung by the All-State Choir of Nebraska several years ago. It is so fun to watch this video and to see on the faces of these young men and women the joy that you are giving them by giving them such a spectacular piece of music and making a difference in the world. Thank you for being part of the morning show today, and very best wishes with all that you undertake from here.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.